Accession number 27185, Reel 7.
Major Barras, Reel 7. You were explaining that the second-in-command had had to take control of the battalion in the absence of the battalion commander through injury.
Yes.
Was there a difference in command styles between these two senior officers?
Well, they were different characters entirely. I mean, I was a platoon commander in those days and, of course, didn't have day-to-day contact with the CO. I wouldn't have expected I had a company commander who was my immediate chief. But Blessed, who was the commander, the normal commander, was a rumbustious character with a lot of charisma. He was very good with young officers. He was full of fun. He was in the First World War. He had ginger hair and a ginger moustache, I remember. And he had a short fuse at times and could blow up, but generally speaking he was a very good leader and much respected by everybody, and he could be a lot of fun. I suspect he was quite a lad in his younger days. On the other hand, Claude Wilson was totally different. He was quiet, competent. I think he had a quiet sense of humour. He didn't have the sort of same sort of outgoing sense of humour that Blessed had, but he had a quiet sense of humour, and he was very competent. And I think, as I said before, when he took over, it was due to his calm and wise leadership that got the battalion to Dunkirk in good order.
Did you notice if the soldiers had any preference for one CO or the other?
Not really at that stage. I mean, they accepted really what came.
Do you think they were very conscious of the CO, or were their horizons really concentrated more on company level or platoon level?
Well, I think in barracks you see much more of the CO than you do on the battlefield, especially here. I mean, obviously the CO gets around, but he didn't have. It wasn't the same as in, say, later in Normandy, where the CO could get around because we were more static and were in defensive positions quite a lot of the time. Here we were on the move so much. And he was busy sort of trying to plan our next move. He was going off to have a look at the positions we were going to take up later and so forth. So I don't think the soldiers during this particular campaign, the retreat from Brussels to Dunkirk, we saw much of the CO actually in the front areas.
You were saying that you got a really heavy air attack, which did you quite a lot of damage at Fromelles.
Mm.
Did that have any noticeable effect on the morale or military spirit of the soldiers in the platoon?
No, not much. No, don't think so. Don't remember it. They were quite an implacable lot, the old pre-war regulars. They just took things in their stride, really. And by this time, of course, people were so tired, you probably didn't notice the difference between a bomb or a motorcycle backfiring, really. I think we were alive to what was happening. I mean, we weren't that tired. But we'd had so little sleep during the march.
Some people say that when you're really very tired indeed, you cease to feel the sense of danger or fear that you would if you were fully alert and rested. Do you think that's true?
I think that's true, yeah. Certainly when I was at Dunkirk, I didn't fear. I don't remember any feeling of fear at all.
I think you said that you were at Fromelles for about a day or so.
Yeah,
and then, did you dig in Fromelles?
No, we didn't have any sort of frontline commitment there at all. We were just sort of staging, I think. Whether we were expected to go and do something else, I don't know. But I just remember being there for the day.
What happened after Fromelles?
Well, it must have been about this time, I think, that the CO told us that we were now going to Dunkirk, as if we hadn't sort of probably realised it already. But Dunkirk wasn't the word in our vocabulary at that time. And I remember him saying, because I had to attend a conference, all the officers at that stage, because it was a total It was going to be a big thing going to Dunkirk and being evacuated, so he got all the officers together, saying that we were going via a place called Watto, W-A-T-O-U, I remember, and then to Dunkirk. So we set off on our usual sort of marching. We were marching staggered down the road. And we came to a place, I remember, and we stopped, and we halted, and we got off the road for a routine rest. And after we'd been there a little bit, I looked around, and I couldn't see my company commander anywhere. He was a fairly old, well, to me, I mean, I was 20 then. He was in his mid-40s, I would think. Probably 42 to 45. He was in the First War. I couldn't see him anywhere. So I walked back down the road where we'd come, round a bend which took me out of sight of the battalion, and there I found him on the side of the road, with his sitting up with his boots off, sort of twinkling his toes, and I said, "Hello, so what's happening?" And he said, I can't go any further. And he by the look of him, most of our company commanders were of this age at that time, and I mean, they'd done their best to get as far as they could, and a lot of them managed all the way. So he said, "I'm not going any further." He said, you take over command of the battalion, of the company." He said, "I'm going to stay here." So I can't remember the exact conversation that took place. I probably pointed out the lack of facilities and prison of war camps and one or two other things which might have appealed to him. But after a bit, I think I managed to persuade him to put his boots on again, and we walked back to where's the battalion, where we left the battalion. Got round the bend in the road and looked down the road, and it was completely empty.
They'd moved on while you were...
They'd gone. And I remember this because there were no refugees down that road. The Luftwaffe wasn't bothering us, and it was absolutely quiet as anything. I mean, you couldn't hear anything. And we just stood there. And looked, nothing. So as soon as we got over the initial shock, I think we decided that we'd better get moving and try and catch them up. So we started walking down the road where the battalion would have gone, in the expectation that hopefully we'd catch them up somewhere. And we got back onto the the main road to Dunkirk, where the crowds were moving. At this stage, the nearer to Dunkirk we got, the less refugees there were, and the more soldiers, because there was no point in the refugees going to Dunkirk, because no one was going to take them in ships away. What happened to the refugees after we left, I have no idea. I don't think half the refugees knew where they were going. The blitzkrieg which the Germans had launched was so swift that I imagine that a lot of them are back home again. Within 2 or 3 weeks, if they could, if they found a home at all. Because there were places like Poperinge and the other place I remember, Alost, which were totally destroyed. So a lot of them would go home and find they didn't have a house anymore. Anyway, we started down this road, and I lost contact with him somehow or other. We got mixed up in the crowd.
When you were walking with him, was he able to keep up with you?
As far as I can remember, he was. He got back.
He did?
Yeah, because I remember seeing him again in the UK when I got there.
But when he was saying to you, you'd got to take over the company.
Yeah.
And was that because you were the senior subaltern in the company at the time?
No, I wouldn't have been the senior subaltern. I think I was probably the only one.
Others were sergeant majors.
We had PSMs, I mentioned before. We didn't have a second in command. We couldn't have had a second in command of the company at that time either. So I don't know. Perhaps it was the first thing that came to his head. It was the nearest one, so he said, "You take over."
Do you remember what you thought to yourself when you were confronted with the possibility that you might have to take command of the company?
No, not a bit. No, I can't remember at all. I just didn't accept it, I think. I just thought, "Well, I've got to get this fellow moving again. Otherwise he's going to finish up." You can't leave someone on the side of the road, can you, and say, "Okay, well, enjoy the rest of the war," courtesy of the German prisoner of war camp. So.
It sounds almost as though there was a reversal in the normal role there, because he should have been giving you a...
Well, he should have been, yes.
...song playing papers
yes.
the other way around.
Yes, yes. I don't know. He was quite an eccentric character, actually. A lot of these older officers were fairly sort of eccentric. They were characters. And as I think, I don't know whether I mentioned this before, but of course the soldiers love an officer or a senior NCO who's eccentric. It gives them an interest in life. Right. Providing he does his job, and look, you know, he knows his job and that sort of thing. But if he's got a little eccentricity on the side, well, it helps keep the day pass, let the day pass. Yeah.
Provides entertainment.
Provides a little entertainment, yes.
Some officers have been known to actually fake or assume an eccentricity.
Oh, I'm sure they did. Yeah.
Or exaggerate an eccentricity.
Yes, I wouldn't. I don't think any of ours did. I wouldn't like someone who actually did it, actually, because it's rather sort of faking, isn't it? Your personality.
So he was the genuine.
He was genuine eccentric. Yes, yes.
What form did his eccentricity take?
I don't know. It was just his sort of general sort of attitude. He wasn't a very large chap. I was told that he used to, when he was in India, he used to slide down the banisters in the full moon. But whether that was just someone exaggerating as to what he used to do, I don't know. But
so somehow you got separated in the
yes.
crush on the road, presumably
yes.
with all refugees. And
right.
What happened to you then?
I continued to walk. I couldn't see him anywhere, so anyway, it was hopeless to try and find him again. So I continued to walk in the direction of Dunkirk. I do remember at this stage that there was fair cloud cover and there was some rain. So we weren't bothered with the Luftwaffe very much at that stage. And not being too hot, I suppose we've been walking all 3 weeks now, was easier than it probably had been, although I was getting, like everybody else, I was just getting tireder. I must have supported myself, I suppose, with some bully beef, which I may have had in a tin, because we were given a tin of bully beef and some biscuits because food was coming very short. I remember I ran short of water, and walking down the road, I saw a pump, one of the old-fashioned pumps with a big lever, you know, you pump the water up and it gushes out. So I went in there, and whilst I was looking at it, a Frenchman, and I remember he was a typical French, he was wearing a black beret, so he must have been French, came out. And I don't know how we arranged it, but I lay under the pump with my mouth facing upwards to the aperture where the water came out, and he pumped. And it gushed all over me, and the whole of my upper body got soaking wet. But I managed, by keeping my mouth open, managed to get some of the water down to quench my thirst. And after a bit, he stopped, and I got up and filled my bottle. He didn't seem to think it was at all odd, you know, to do this sort of thing. He might have been a petrol pump attendant just coming out to fill up a car. I filled my bottle up, and I said, "Merci bien," and he said, didn't say very much, I don't think, and off I went. I suppose he said, shrugged his shoulders and said, "Les Anglais," and that was it. At some stage after that, I got hold of a woman's bike from somewhere, and I remember cycling along on this. And the next thing I can remember is arriving at a place called Baig, B-A-G-U-E-S, I'm sure it was called, pronounced Baig. And that was that was some high ground there, and I got my first glimpse of Dunkirk, which was still several miles away. And I could just see the sort of outline of the coast and the little dots of aircraft, Luftwaffe, swooping down and climbing up again, bombing and starting the shipping, which was lying off the coast. The other thing which I saw was a great big black smoke coming up from the oil refinery, which they'd obviously bombed in Dunkirk, near the Dunkirk harbour itself. And it sort of reached up into the sky and produced a great big cloud which sort of overhung the whole town. So I then, having witnessed this scene, I then began to descend and made my way towards Dunkirk. And just as I got on the outskirts of Dunkirk, I was stopped by a military police patrol.
Do you remember where you crossed the canal? Because the perimeter, I think, around Dunkirk was on the Yser and the Yser Canal, wasn't it?
Yes, there was.
Running down through, from Newport, down through Vulpen to Fern, and then on down to Dunkirk itself.
I don't recall crossing it at all. I must have done, but I don't recall crossing it.
Yeah. So you were getting close to Dunkirk, and
I was in the outskirts of the town now, yes. And they were stopping people and sending them down to the beaches where La Pan. And I went down there.
What was the condition of Dunkirk like when you got to its outskirts?
Well, there were the roads, but the nearer you got to Dunkirk, of course, the more the roads became littered with lorries, cars, guns, which had all been burnt, broken up. Guns had been spiked along the side of the road. A very sad sight, actually, to see all this. It must have been gone on for 2 or 3 miles before I got to Dunkirk. But the middle of the road was clear, so people were still walking down the middle of the road, or marching down if they'd been battalions and properly formed.
Were there many soldiers actually marching formed up properly?
I can't remember, but I know certainly our battalion was, I was told afterwards, and I imagine that most of the infantry battalions of the regular divisions anyway would have been. And I'm not sure, I suspect a lot of the TA as well. And they weren't as well trained as the regular soldiers in that respect, but they had the hearts of lions, I'm sure, a lot of them.
Did you when you were walking down the road, did you get any news of where battalion had gone?
No.
People on the road?
No. Nobody knew.
Nobody knew anything?
No.
What did the military policemen say to you then when you stopped?
I just can't remember exactly what they said, but I remember I can see them in my mind's eye now, talking to me and just directing me. I mean, they were directing everybody down there. Except possibly that the formed battalions or formed regiments were being allowed through to get onto the mole.
Yes.
But of course, a lot of them went to the beaches, then got on the mole from there. Because
presumably some were being diverted to positions in the perimeter to.
Well, but I would have passed through the perimeter by then.
Yes.
Yeah. So I don't remember that either.
You don't remember any formed body in defensive positions?
No, I don't at all.
So you sent that down towards La Pan.
I remember some rain.
Yes.
Before I got to Dunkirk, but after I got there, of course, it cleared, and that is why I could then from Begg see the aircraft out to sea.
Yes.
Although there was cloud higher up, I think, but it was not too low, so low that it stopped the Luftwaffe from operating.
Did you go through this place called Begg or around it?
I don't remember. I know that the
anything about it.
No. Begg was I'm not sure whether it was a village or a feature. I think the hill itself was probably called Begg. It's just one, it's a word that stays in my mind, and that's my first sight of Dunkirk.
So you were directed towards Dupin, and how did you get there? Did you just walk along?
Oh, I just walked, yeah. It wasn't very far from there, actually. I entered from the back through the dunes at the back. I can remember as I walked in there seeing a lot of soldiers dug in amongst the dunes. Now, whether there was any queues on the beaches at that time, I don't know. The next day there were, but I can't remember on this particular day. There must have been people on the beach itself, the sands in front, because I was walking around asking anybody who looked intelligent and still awake if they'd seen the battalion. And, of course, nobody had. I don't think they would have known one battalion from another, quite honestly, a lot of them. So eventually, all this time, of course, there was Luftwaffe were busy bombing the ships out at sea. They must have been bombing and strafing down the beach from time to time as well, but I don't think that was, looking back in it, I don't think their major target was the beach at all. They destroyed the harbour, except for the mole, the eastern mole and the western moles, and was now concentrating on the shipping. I mean, when you come to think of it, it wouldn't have been to their advantage to just go and kill people on the beaches and then have to clear them up afterwards when they arrived and then put all the wounded in hospital. But they did go down the beach now and again. But I can't specifically remember any particular raid. I remember some of the British soldiers in the dunes shouting abuse at the aircraft, at the pilots, presumably, of the Luftwaffe aircraft as they roared past. And some of them were taking pot shots with their rifles. I think there's still some machine guns around at that time as well. But what they were saying, I don't know. I imagine some of the Anglo-Saxon words were useful. But
was there any flak going up against the aircraft from the
only
ships?
From the ships, mm. as far as I remember. Mm. Probably more inland, where the perimeter was, there may have been still some guns operating on there. But I think most of the heavy aircraft, the 37s, would have all been spiked and gone, I think, by then. So you're just left with
the light. Light guns, presumably.
I don't think we had any of the light guns in those days. I think we just had to rely on hosing tracers from Bren guns. And there was some of that, but I don't remember if there was any tracer. They probably didn't have any tracer by then. And I think it was at this time, after I arrived on the beach, that I saw a hospital ship. Which was very clearly marked with crosses down the side. I can see it to this day, being attacked and sunk. And perhaps it was, because I was tired, one minute I saw it there and the next minute it wasn't. And then shortly after that, a destroyer was hit. And I saw that too. And that went down more slowly. I can see that going down. And that had its AK-AK gun still firing when it was sinking below the waves. Its pom-poms, I don't even remember, we used to call those the quick-firing guns, which was a very inspiring sight, I suppose. I didn't probably realise at the time. But a very sad one. And that sank beneath the waves as well. And those are the two ships I remember. There were others, obviously. I mean, there were over 200 were sunk, actually, off Dunkirk. Of all types. So after I'd been wandering around for a little, I was beginning to almost to go to sleep standing up. And then I found an ambulance which had been abandoned and driven into the sand. Back doors open. I looked in. There was a stretcher. So I just climbed in and lay down and went to sleep and left the rattle of war outside. I don't know how long I was asleep for. Must be several hours. I suppose an exceptionally big bang woke me up. And when I woke up, it must have been the next day anyway. I can remember going to the doors and looking out and trying to focus a couple of rather blurry eyes, because there's nothing worse than not getting enough sleep when you're tired. And seeing that the Luftwaffe were back in business out at sea and bombing and strafing. And I went back on the beach, and the worky was now, I remember this, right down to the water's edge.
I was going to ask you whether there was any sign of anyone in control or taking charge when you first arrived.
Well, this I can't remember when I first arrived. Perhaps steep sharpened my wit. That little bit of steep I got did sharpen my wits a little. So I did see these queues down, right down to the water's edge. They were quite wide, and they went back to the dunes. And I can't remember at this stage whether they were waist-deep into the sea. I can only assume the pictures we got of those waist-deep in the sea was when the tide was in, because you couldn't shuffle these great big queues backwards and forwards according to the tide. Anyway, I walked around most of the day looking right up and down the beach, because it's quite a long beach there, and there were a hell of a lot of people there. And eventually I saw, I came across an officer who looked to me as if he was just one of the ones who come up from the UK, because they did send a group across to control the whole thing from the UK, and it was really well controlled, actually. I mean, it was controlled chaos. And I asked him, because he looked alert and bright of eye, so he must have come from the UK recently. And he said he hadn't seen them anywhere, and he said the best thing I'd better do, he said they must have gone. And he directed me to get into a rowing boat. So I waded out, and this little rowing boat was off a bit with some other soldiers getting into it, I remember. I waded out to it. I didn't have to go far. I think it was sort of up to my bottom of my stomach. I didn't go very far. Hauled myself into this little rowing boat and found to my delight that it was being rowed by Royal Navy Matlows. So we started off, we got a boatload, and they started rowing us out to...
How many soldiers were there in there?
I just can't remember.
Do you remember how many oarsmen there were rowing?
Four, I think. Yeah.
Was it sort of whaler? Or
it must have been a whaler, I suppose. It was from the destroyer we went out to. And it took us some time, and it just goes to show how slow the embarking troops off the beaches must have been. So eventually we got out to HMS Antony, which was a destroyer. And when we got alongside, there was this scrambling net let down the side, which we all clambered up, got on deck. And I was luckily ushered down into the wardroom. When I got there, there was a sort of mess table there. There were about three or four other officers who had preceded me there. Three of them had their heads on the table and were fast asleep. One was still sitting up with a blanket over him, I remember. And when I looked inside the blanket, I found he was asleep as well. So I was given a nice hot cup of maybe cocoa. It's about the first hot drink anything hot I'd had for several days, I think. Now, I can't remember how much of that I drank before I joined the guys on the table. But I certainly must have done, and I did. And I don't remember any of the voyage at all.
So you were just sitting at the table with your head on it?
Yeah, just sitting around the table.
You were asleep?
Yeah, yes, that's right.
Who brought you the cocoa, was it?
It was a Matlow, soldier. I mean, not a sailor. Mm. Yeah. I think he must have been the mess steward, probably.
Maintaining normal services?
Oh, yes, he was carrying on as usual. I mean, he was whether asleep or alive. No, they looked after us very well. And, of course, I do remember that the destroyer was bunged up with troops all over the place. I don't know how many were supposed to have been... would have been feasible to take without jeopardising the stability of the ship. But I'm sure there were more there than would normally have been carried. It was a captain's decision at the end of the day.
So you weren't aware of the ship leaving the coast or anything like that?
No. I know we weren't attacked at all after we left. We went to Ramsgate. A lot of the ships went to Dover, of course. We, for some reason, went to Ramsgate. They obviously had to distribute the loads around the country because of the trains and everything else and the capacity of the docks alongside room.
So what's that? You remember, presumably, having your cup of cocoa and
whether I finished it or not, I don't know.
First ship, and then the memory goes all blank again. And then what was the next thing you remember happening then? Was this the arrival at Ramsgate?
No.
Awake?
No. I don't remember that. We must have been put in lorries and taken up to the station because I don't believe there are any rails that come down to the quayside there, like Dover. Put on a train, and the next thing I can remember is being in this train in a mainline station somewhere along the way, looking out of the window and seeing a whole lot of jolly ladies from the WVS and all kinds of other services, charities and so forth, or voluntary services, dishing out with a great urn of tea, plates of buns and things, and dishing them out to the along the wall, right the way along the train to the troops, who were all by now a bit more lively and looking out of the windows and indulging in the usual.